Hi, I'm James.
And I'm Anthony.
And this is Words and Numbers.
What's new and exciting in your world this week, Anthony?
Listener Dan Jensen wrote and said, thank you for mentioning the merchant category code for gun stores in a recent episode. This is the rule that purchases from gun stores get a special code attached to them so that we know, or we, people who are processing data on purchases and sales of things, can identify that this was a gun store purchase. Up until this point, gun store purchases went under some code for general merchandise. So now with this code, people can identify gun store purchases. Dan says that there may be an unfortunate interaction between this merchant category code for gun stores and a bill that was proposed last year and may well come up again this year, and it's got a horrible name, the Gun Violence Prevention Through Financial Intelligence Act. This proposed law would require banks to file suspicious activity reports for certain firearm transactions. So now all of a sudden, if you combine this horribly named law with the new merchant category code for gun stores, banks have the ability to identify purchases at gun stores via this new code. And with this poorly named law, Gun Violence Prevention Through the Financial Intelligence Act, because the banks may be required to file suspicious activity reports, the banks themselves may throw up their hands and say, look, we can't handle the liability of failing to report things that we should have reported, and so therefore we're going to decline all purchases that have to do with gun stores.
Or, probably just as bad, they will categorize everything as suspicious.
For those who may think we're jumping off the deep end here, I refer you to a similar law that require banks to report transactions of over $10,000 in cash. And there have been many reports of people with cash-based businesses going to deposit money from their business. This is legitimate cash. And then finding that the government has confiscated the money because the bank reported it, because the bank had to, as suspicious activity.
And then you have to prove that it wasn't.
Yes, there is no innocent until proven guilty here. You are literally guilty until you prove that this money did not come via nefarious means.
And in the spirit of civil asset forfeiture, the money itself is guilty. Just patently absurd, but perhaps you've got something a little happier to talk about.
My home state of Pennsylvania is considering a bill that would allow people who are trying to break the bonds of alcoholism to register with the state, and the state would then put them on a list that prohibited them from buying alcohol in the state. So the idea is, in a moment of sobriety, I realize I've got to break this cycle, so I sign up for the thing, my name gets put on the list, and for a period of, it's proposed 5 years, for a period of 5 years, I cannot purchase alcohol in the state. What fascinates me about this is it's completely voluntary. Nobody's required to do this. You do it voluntarily. And it seems to me to be, for once, a good use of state power, in that the state stands ready to help you out with this if indeed you want help with your alcoholism.
All right, hold the phone, because I think, as usual, you're far too Pollyannish about this. Here's what's actually going to happen. Judges are going to tell defendants that they're going to opt in on this list. People will be required to opt in if they want, you know, a lesser sentence for some terrible thing they have done.
Well, and that's interesting, because the representative, Matthew Dowling, who's proposing this, has foreseen exactly the wrinkle you're suggesting, and is saying in the bill that this program, if you want to call it that, may not be used in court proceedings or potential plea deals.
It's good that somebody is seeing the obvious from a position inside the legislature. That rarely happens.
Well, I can tell you what I would guess is going to happen here. If indeed this bill does go through with the footnote that the program cannot be used in court proceedings or potential plea deals, people, myself included, are going to think this is a good idea. And at some point, a couple of years down the road, there's going to be a quiet little bill that's passed that removes that footnote. And all of a sudden, people are going to be forced onto this list.
And it's going to say something like, look, because this has been so good as a voluntary option, it will be even better as an as involuntary option.
Right.
That's right. I've got something that should be quite a lot more uplifting. You know how these outer space things, I can't help but be fascinated by them. NASA is going to crash a spacecraft into a 525-foot wide asteroid in September. We've got this problem. Well, it hasn't been a problem for a little over 60 million years, but every now and again, some giant rock from outer space crashes into the Earth. Were that to happen now, the human race could actually be functionally wiped out. So it's in our interest to start studying these gigantic asteroids, finding what their nearest approach to Earth is going to look like, and then maybe send something into outer space to intercept them and shove them in some other direction. This is kind of astonishing. In a week or so, NASA will do this. And apparently, right before their spacecraft hits the asteroid, a smaller spacecraft is going to be released from which we can all watch it happen live.
Oh, yeah. We get TikToks of the satellite hitting them.
How cool is that, right?
So just to go back, the purpose of this, of slamming the spacecraft into the asteroid, is to nudge it, is to move the asteroid.
Correct.
That's going to be interesting. And I suppose, of course, someone somewhere has done the math to verify that nudging this asteroid is not going to be nudging it toward us. It's going to be nudging it in the other direction.
I'm sure that's how everybody hopes it will work out. I'm a little concerned, frankly, about exactly the outcome that you mentioned. But this asteroid is not going to find its way to Earth in any event. We happen to be in the neighborhood. We're looking to test the technology. And I can't wait to sit here and watch that happen live. I'm absolutely going to be online watching this transpire. Which brings us, Ant, to the foolishness of the week. I don't want to be mean-spirited about this. I don't offer this in a spirit of hostility at all. I'm just saying that I don't get it. It's, of course, the Queen's funeral and how several countries just stopped doing anything because of the death of a monarch. You know, she seemed to be, I think, a very interesting woman, selfless in her own way, doing things that she thought and that many other people thought were for the common good. My trouble is having a monarch in the first place. I just don't understand why anybody would want a monarch, benign or otherwise. People say, well, it's kind of a signal to the rest of the world. And I'm thinking, yeah, it's kind of a signal to the rest of the world, a signal you ought not be making. I kind of would hope that our friends in the UK might start thinking about undoing the entirety of the monarchy in the first place. Just get rid of it entirely.
For all of the bashing we do of our government here, I'm not sure that anybody should be taking advice on governing from Americans at the moment.
I don't presume to tell our friends what they should be doing. I'm just saying what I would be interested in seeing. And those are two completely different things.
Well, I was thinking about this the other day. One thing a monarch does, at least in the way they seem to be doing it in UK, is provide a backstop. We've dealt in this country on more than one occasion with crazy people being in various branches of government. And we have no backstop. When one branch goes crazy, we've got to rely on the other two to bring it into line. A monarch seems to me to be the, how should I say, the last ditch effort in restoring sanity when government goes awry.
What I do think is that any reference in any governing structure to a monarch is likely to cause problems at some point. That said, the British seem to have gotten away with it for quite some time now without having a problem, at least in the last 100 years or so. Right? You look back before that and there are all kinds of problems. But they seem to have defanged the monarchy. I mean, that's fine. I just don't get it.
To get more Ant and James, buy a copy of our excellent book, Cooperation and Coercion. You can find the paper and electronic versions on Amazon and the audio version on Audible. If you'd like to support Words and Numbers, make your way over to patreon.com/wordsandnumbers, where you can contribute to our podcast-making habits. If you'd like to schedule us to come speak at your event, be it corporate or educational, or have James officiate at your wedding, send us an email at wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com.
This episode is the first of a two-part series on the constitutional limits on the federal government. One of our listeners asked us to do an episode on Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, or in layman's terms, a discussion about what the federal government is empowered to do by the Constitution versus what it actually does. I'm going to let you, James, say most of what happens here since this is your area of expertise, but I'm going to take the role of an interested non-expert. I want to begin by pointing out that the Constitution, contrary to people's beliefs, does not lay out people's rights. Rather, it lays out the authority of the federal government. And that confusion, if I'm correct, comes about because of the Bill of Rights.
In a lot of ways, yes, that's correct. But Alexander Hamilton, when he was writing in the Federalist, Federalist Papers, as most people would call it, he said that we didn't even need a Bill of Rights because the Constitution was very specific in regards to what Congress could do. And if you look at Article 1, Section 8, you realize, okay, the limits are defined pretty clearly, and they can't do anything else. If they can't do anything else, why would you need a separate protection for free speech?
Right.
The federal government already has no role there. So to religion and on and on and on. And I think Hamilton was right. I didn't when I was a younger man. I thought, no, probably best to get a Bill of Rights all sketched out. That way there's less room for confusion. But if you look at what the Bill of Rights actually did over time, it did quite a lot of harm.
Yeah, we're in this weird space where people think that their rights are enumerated. You say, I have a freedom of speech because it's listed in the Constitution, but that's actually upside down. The federal government only has powers that are enumerated. And that brings us to Article 1, Section 8.
The Bill of Rights begins, Congress shall not.
So in that sense, it's underlining the fact that the Constitution does not give Congress certain rights.
It protects some rights that the people have. It keeps government in its place, or at least ideally. You see how these things are going to be very difficult to apply over time. It's really clear that what we have now in terms of government far exceeds what the founders would have thought appropriate. That doesn't necessarily mean that what we have is wrong. It just means that it's not what we were given.
Right.
I think some hard questions come up that you have to answer in order to figure out, is this better or worse than what they gave us? What they gave us was a regime which featured negative rights. Government had no role. This is a very strange way to conceive of a government. What we're looking at in the United States early on is a radically different experiment than we've seen anywhere else in the world.
Maybe the place to start is with Article 1, Section 8 itself. In other words, in the view of the founders, what was the federal government authorized to do?
We got to start with the Declaration of Independence. We assert our independence from England. And what does Jefferson do there? Because he has a respect for the opinions of people in other places, here's why we're doing it. And if you read all the reasons why, they're kind of legalistic. I'm never going to make the case that the Declaration of Independence is some kind of law for us. It's not. It's a philosophical and a political document. It's not a legal one. But a number of the legal things that are wrapped up in that middle section of the Declaration actually do play out over time into our law. Technically colonial law for a little bit and then United States law. And this one fascinating thing happened that we all ignore. A group of people got together and they wrote a constitution for us, and it limited the ability of the federal government to do damn near anything, and it flopped. And we never talk about it. It's the Articles of Confederation, our first constitution. Everybody thinks the one we've got now is the only one we ever had. No. We had a first one. It was dreadful, and we threw it away as fast as we possibly could. What ended up happening was there was a convention. This is making a long story very, very short. The convention was called in order to address the defects of the Articles of Confederation. Okay, there were defects. We just had Shays' Rebellion in Massachusetts. There's all kinds of things that are going to be really problematic. And a bunch of guys got together to decide how to rehabilitate the articles. And what they did was they said, oh, Lord, these can't be fixed. And they threw it out. They didn't have the legal authority to do it. Nobody contests that. They absolutely had the moral authority to do it. So people who tend to see things in legalistic ways will often say, correctly, technically, that the Constitutional Convention was illegal. The rest of us say, well, the governing document that we had was not yielding governing, and you've got to fix that. So what's the charge that they have in the Constitutional Convention in the summer of 1787? They need to create a document which, for the most part, limited federal authority. But in the few things that the federal government had to do, they get a wide open berth.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, you want it to be limited. And on the other hand, you have to admit that certain parts of it must be limitless. That is a tough needle to thread. And that's where we properly begin thinking about these things. Article 1, Section 8 exists solely to limit government.
And once more to underline, Article 1, Section 8 does not say what the federal government may not do. Rather, it's the reverse. It says what the federal government may do, and anything not listed is outside the purview of the federal government.
Article 1, Section 8 lays out what Congress may do. Americans right now think that, and they think it appropriate that, government can do anything. You see the people pressuring the government to do lots of things. The people in government, congressmen and senators, in order to achieve re-election, decide to do lots of things because that's way better for them than paying attention to the Constitution. And before you know it, we've got a government that is so far beyond its specified dimensions that I don't even know what to do about it anymore. Now, we're going to give you a link to Article 1, Section 8, so you can get a look at it. It includes this kind of stuff: the power to lay and collect taxes, defense and general welfare of the United States, all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the country. They have the ability to borrow money on the credit of the United States. Boy, that one turned around kind of poorly, didn't it? They have the ability to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. And you start to realize that this is a higher order list. This is a list that never really gets into the weeds. To raise and support armies, to provide a navy. These are just big picture.
One of the things that jumped out at me as I'm looking at the list, there are a couple of things that become a little more specific. One is to establish post offices.
Yeah.
And post roads.
That's right. This came up at the Supreme Court at one point, and the argument was, look, if the Constitution specifies post offices and post roads, these are things that are very clear and wide out in the open. These are expressed. Doesn't it imply the delivery of the mail?
Interesting, right.
And look, why would you build post offices and post roads if you weren't going to deliver the mail? And yet, delivering the mail is not in the enumerated powers.
I don't want to jump too far ahead, but it would be covered by the Necessary and Proper Clause, which says Congress may make any law that is pursuant to the authority laid out in the Constitution. So you could point to that and say, well, the Constitution establishes post offices, therefore it's necessary and proper that we also deliver the mail.
You're right to point to that clause. It's at the last portion of the section we're looking at. And here it is verbatim. Congress has the authority to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. It doesn't mandate that the government do certain things. It means that the government must justify what it's about to do with this, the Necessary and Proper Clause. Now, we're going to get into the Commerce Clause real soon, too.
Okay, so in layman's terms, the Necessary and Proper Clause does not say that the Congress can do whatever it wants in pursuant to what's in Article 1, Section 8, but rather Congress may make the argument that it is necessary and proper. If the thing it wants to do fits both of those criteria, then Congress can go ahead and do it.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly reasonable. And it's the kind of thing that if you were writing a constitution, you might have said, what happens in an emergency? What if some new reality is upon us and we can get Congress to act with a certain amount of dispatch, but what are we going to let them get away with? If you realize that your government will occasionally have to exert great power, Well, you have to give them that authority. Now, you're going to give them that authority on the hope that the document you've just written will pull it back after exigent circumstances disappear. But you and I both know, and anybody who really takes a look at human nature or politics in any one place will say that no matter what special authority a government gets for itself, it will retain that authority after that authority is no longer required.
I want to point to a couple of other things. And for those of you that have not looked at this, there are, what, 9 or 10 things listed here in Article 1, Section 8. So this is not a huge list.
It's bigger than that. But your ultimate point is correct. You could read this in the space of 45 seconds.
Yeah, we're not talking about hundreds of things listed here. But two things that jump out at me. One is the authority, quote, to coin money and regulate the value thereof. Now, people make the argument that the Federal Reserve is unconstitutional. I can see an argument in both directions here, because on the one hand, Article 1, Section 8 gives not only Congress the authority to coin money, but that regulate the value thereof. That's what we're dealing with right now with inflation. We printed lots of money and now the value of the dollar has declined. So on the one hand, I can point to Article 1, Section 8 as support for the existence of the Fed. But then on the other hand, there's nothing here that says that Congress can allocate that power to another party, which in effect was what it did with the creation of the Fed.
Yeah, it does that all the time.
It does it all the time, right.
The correct way to look at that is to say, hey, wait a minute. Is this consonant with Article 1, Section 8? And look, this goes all the way back to the formation of the Second National Bank of the United States. Washington had around his table both Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. And he said, Washington, I think we should do this bank thing, but I'm not so sure. Why don't you, Thomas and Alexander, because you disagree about everything, go ahead and write up why you think and why you don't think this would be necessary and proper. And you can get these documents with relative ease. They're everywhere. Jefferson showed up with a very short bullet-pointed list of why this is completely unacceptable. And he hangs his hat on the language of the Constitution. And in walks Alexander Hamilton with more like a dime store novel's worth of words of why it may not seem the case, but we absolutely do need this authority. It would be analogous to people now saying things like, well, we need to have an income tax, therefore we can have roads to drive on. We had roads before the income tax. It's not like we were in the middle of a hellscape before the income tax came along. That's ridiculous. We were not. Nonetheless, you see this argument about the bank, and I was utterly swayed by Jefferson when I read what he wrote. I didn't think Hamilton's offering held any merit whatsoever. And of course, it was Hamilton that George Washington listened to. This was almost always true. And we live in Hamilton's America now as a result. When you look at the Constitution and the Necessary and Proper Clause, do we really need a Fed? Is the Fed necessary to coin money? Because coining money to me sounds like we need a mint, which we have. That's what we need. We need a place to make the money. Do we need a place to regulate the money behind the scenes? Where in the Article 1, Section 8 list do you see anything that leads you to that conclusion?
And we survived for over 100 years without the Fed. Fed didn't come into existence till the early 1900s.
And Ant, because you were playing devil's advocate here, my question is offered to you. What do you see in Article 1, Section 8 that would get anything like the Fed if I'm right about mints being what we really need?
Yeah, no, I don't see anything there if we're going to be talking about coins. And that's the phrase that it uses, to coin money.
And broadly construed, that also means paper notes, right? There was never really a whole lot of doubt that paper notes.
Yeah, but then there's this other issue, which is that at least at the time this was written, the concept of fiat money really didn't exist. That is, paper money where it existed was always backed by something. It was backed by gold or silver or what have you. It was understood that the paper was simply a convenient thing to carry around that indicated ownership of some gold or silver somewhere.
And look, I'm not a historian of money. I've kind of traipsed through that history from time to time, but I'm not that expert in this material. But it's always seemed to me that if you want to hang your hat on coining money, and that literal phrase, coining money, that actually slows down the production of money to such a degree that you probably don't need anything else.
Sure. That's a good point.
It's when it slows it down so much that people can't be paid for the work they've done because nobody has the coinage. That's where the problems start. And if you go back through our history, you can find all kinds of paper notes that the colonies pushed out. Colonial paper notes, I think, are absolutely beautiful, very fascinating, and not terribly expensive given what they are. $300-$400 a piece is tend to where they run. But you see the need for that, just for people to actually have an IOU of some kind for the work that they've done. Exigent circumstances here, I think, would have indicated that, yeah, we're going to need paper money too, and we're going to call that coinage, and we're going to be good to go.
A couple more things that jump out at me here in Article 1, Section 8. This one particularly jumped out at me because my sister is a professor of theater and dance and so deals with the National Endowment for the Arts frequently. There's this entry under Article 1, Section 8, Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts. Now, I would imagine by useful arts, they did not mean theater and dance, but nonetheless, I read that and say, oh, look, there's some authorization for the National Endowment for the Arts. Until you go on and read the rest of the sentence, Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. This was not giving the authority to establish a national endowment for the arts or even for the sciences. Rather, it was simply giving Congress the authority to create patents and copyrights.
This is the patents clause, and it's pretty clear once you dig into it. This is always the problem. People look at these things, and then the minute they get the answer they want, they stop reading.
Right.
Well,
sure.
You got to keep on reading. It's kind of like where the anti-gun people find themselves. They see a well-regulated militia and they held up their arms and they say, hooray, we don't have to deal with this anymore. Shall not be infringed.
Right. Right.
That causes them all kinds of grief and aggravation. And so too, the progress of science and the useful arts. I always love that it's the useful arts. This Constitution is where the rubber meets the road. It's about commerce. That's the wave that's going to lift all boats. A couple of lines up, we have Congress with the ability to provide for the punishment of counterfeiting. We can't have you at your house making more money. That's just not going to work.
Now, hang on a second, because this calls to mind something you told me some time ago, that murder is not a federal offense, it's a state offense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, coming back to Article 1, Section 8, do I conclude that the only things that can be federal offenses are things that are called for here in Article 1, Section 8, that is to provide for the punishment of counterfeiting, and I think there's something later on about treason.
Yeah, I mean, a reasonable person would probably think that. The framers gave us Article 3, which is about the judiciary, so the Supreme Court and inferior courts are set up there. The words are very nondescript, but the outline is pretty clear. You got one Supreme Court, multiple lesser courts, which calls to mind the question, okay, if there are all these lesser courts, what kind of cases are they going to be hearing? And, well, at the time, not a lot of murder cases making it through. Let's just say none. Why not? Because federal law didn't include that.
Yeah.
Now, over time, federal law has come to include all manner of things. You might notice, Ant, that a white person is apparently guilty of killing a black person. You get the murder charge at the state level, but then you get the civil rights violation at the federal level. Congress made a whole bunch of civil rights laws that every rational person would look at and say, well, yeah, we kind of needed that. But those cases are heard in federal courts. And that may sound awful, given the direction that we have taken on Article 1, Section 8. But where do you want that case heard? Do you want that case heard in Montgomery, Alabama? Or would you prefer it got pushed out of that a little bit? You see the difficulty that you're up against here. When you look at the nearly perfect text and you can already see where it's not going to fit very well. Do we have federal courts now? Oh, do we ever? Are we ever going to get that genie back in the bottle? I suspect not.
Something interesting that jumps out to the careful reader. There's a line item, at least one line item here, authorizing Congress to raise and support armies. And another one that specifically, this is separate from armies, to provide and maintain a Navy.
Yep.
Nowhere is an Air Force listed.
That's right. Did you ever wonder why the Air Force was part of the Navy?
Originally, yeah.
Here it is. And there's no surprise, right? Because you can't foresee everything. If you look at the First Amendment and the right to a free press, well, okay. At the time of the founding, a free press was a printing press with a literal machine in it that pressed the news in black font onto the newspaper. What's the press now? If I'm a strict constructionist, do I have to say, well, anything that's a newspaper? I think that that's the answer you would have to take from a certain deeply conservative perspective. Of course, nobody does that because everybody knows that there's more to it than that now. We have the television, we have the internet, right? They're all manner of things that fit under the heading of the press. And I don't think we do original intent a whole lot of damage when we see it that way.
That becomes really interesting because you'll get people on the two sides, one saying that, well, of course, the First Amendment applies to computer communications, but the Second Amendment only applies to muskets. And you get people on the other side who say the reverse, and they both either apply to everything or they apply to what was originally written. That's it.
That's right. And I think on these matters, we can divine original intent. It's not that hard. Mm-hmm. There are other issues that you look at the text and you go, I have no idea. Just a quick example. Look at the Constitution and tell me what it says about abortion. There is not word one in this Constitution about abortion, which necessarily means it's not a federal issue. That's the only conclusion you can come to. Now, is it necessary and proper? Well, if so, which of these other rights does it impinge?
Right. It has to be necessary and proper in pursuit of something listed here in Article 1, Section 8.
That's right. And for the life of me, I don't see anything in Article 1, Section 8 that has anything to do with abortion. Now, the original Roe Court attached abortion to privacy. I don't see anything about privacy here either. You've got a tough uphill climb here, because if you want abortion on demand at the federal level, you have to invent two new constitutional rights. That's what the 1974 court did in Roe versus Wade. They invented from whole cloth two new rights. And then, all these years later, the justices take a look at that and they say, well, you know, this is at best a state issue.
Not to say it shouldn't be, but rather, if it's going to be, it needs to be at the state level.
That's absolutely correct. And the people marching in the street won't give this thought even a minute of their time. But if you read the 10th Amendment, it's pretty clear. Anything that's not covered here reverts back to the states. There is not a lot of difficulty with that. The difficulty comes with people wanting the Constitution to say more than it does.
You're going to where my next question was. So the 10th Amendment, and let me read it for people who don't have it in front of them. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. In other words, on the one hand, while the Constitution is going to enumerate these are the specific things the federal government is allowed to do, everything else is left to the states and the people. It's not going to enumerate anything there. For example, originally, the amendment calling for the separation of church and state, and now the proper reading is something to the effect of Congress will make no law regarding the establishment of religion. That did not apply to the states. In other words, you could have a state that declares itself, we're Catholic or we're Jewish or whatever it is, and that's perfectly constitutional.
The 10th Amendment was a dead letter almost from the time the ink was dry on the page.
Because why?
Because that's no fun. That doesn't allow you to do things. No, it got much easier to just say, well, we've got a couple of clauses here that when read together, you know, we could do anything we want. And when we could do anything we want, when politicians realize that, that's what's going to happen. And that's all the time we've got this week on Words and Numbers. Until next time, be sure to follow us on Twitter. Handles are in the show notes. Join Words and Numbers Backstage, the Facebook group where the conversation continues. And
send us email, wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com.
Until next week, try to be nice to one person. One person who doesn't deserve it. Just one. And who knows? It may turn into a trend. Give it a shot. You might feel good about yourself.
You could say you tried.
You tried. That's right. Till next week, can't take it easy.
See you next week, James.